That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Don't touch that dial. You're tuned in to the Dread Podcast Network.
Welcome to Development Hell. For every horror movie that hits VOD, countless others end up DOA. Development Hell is the podcast dedicated to unearthing these cursed horror productions. We're going to find out what went wrong and then decide if these titles still stand a shot at the green light. I am your host, Josh Korngut. I am the managing editor of Dread Central. I am also a filmmaker in Toronto, Canada. This podcast is a proud member of the Dread Podcast Network. Hi, everybody, and welcome back to a brand new episode of Development Hell. As you've noticed, every Tuesday for the month of March, we have been celebrating the lost projects and unproduced films of the legendary George A. Romero within this audio series I'm calling Romero Unseen. Now, today is the last and final and fifth episode of this mini-series, and we're going to take a bit of a different route by celebrating all things Romero. We're going to touch base on what our favorite Romero movies are, and then we're also going to dig into a number of other unproduced Romero projects over the years that we didn't really have time to give a full episode to, but we still want to talk about. Joining me, as always, for Romero Unseen is Adam Charles Hart. He is the author of Raising the Dead, the work of George A. Romero, which is out now from Oxford University Press. So you should definitely head to our show notes and make sure that you pick up a copy. Adam, welcome back to yet another episode of Romero Unseen. How's it going?
Going great. How are you doing, Josh?
I'm good. I'm kind of sad, to be honest, that this is our last episode. I've really enjoyed Romero University.
Yeah, I'll have to hurry up and write another book so I can come back.
Yes, I think that that's wise. So for those who maybe are only tuning in for the first time today, can you just introduce yourself to the Development Hell audience?
Yeah, so I was lucky enough to be one of the people who processed George Romero's archives. I've written about horror and, you know, taught horror studies and such for years, and was just kind of in the right place at the right time. I live in Pittsburgh and was working at Pitt when this archive came in. And it was the most fun I've ever had in my entire life, digging through all of these boxes that nobody had opened in 50 years in some cases. I probably opened it, but didn't go through them well, you know. Mm-hmm. So, as I've said on previous episodes, like, my colleague Ben and I are going through this stuff and I'm like, wait, okay, so what's mainly in here are scripts for movies that we've never heard of. And we're like, there's another one and another one and another one. And very soon we realized, like, oh, this George Romero guy could never stop writing. He just kept making scripts and all the points in his filmography when it looks like, oh, he wasn't doing anything for 10 years.
Yeah,
he wrote like 36 scripts during that point. And when he wasn't doing that, he was writing outlines and developing projects. And like, he was just bursting with ideas at all times. Mm-hmm. So the book started as just a way for me to share how excited I was about all of this stuff, which, you know, it reveals this artist who worked in horror mainly, but who had all of these different interests, you know, like the scripts, there's a lot of horror stuff, but there's a lot of, there's mysteries and comedies and a couple westerns and some science fiction stuff with spaceships and cyborgs and some action movies, some detective stuff. Mm-hmm. He just had all of these interests. And as I was writing what I thought would be this book that was just kind of like, hey, here's all this cool shit I found that you should know about, like all this great work that Romero is doing that he just never got a chance to film. Mm-hmm. I realized that this was giving me a whole new perspective on the movies that we've all seen a million times, like the early drafts of Dawn of the Dead and Day of the Dead, the early drafts of Martin, the other stuff that he was working on at that time and the stuff that he'd been working on leading up to Night of the Living Dead. It was giving me all of these new, I guess it sounds kind of pretentious to say it was giving me all of these new insights, but it really was. Like, the original plan for the book was not to touch any of those because, like, who has anything else to say about Night of the Living Dead at this point? Like, it's over 50 years old and has been written about, you know, more than maybe any other movie in horror history besides Psycho, you know, basically.
I mean, it's arguable, yeah.
But I do feel like it gave me something new to say about it. So, you know, people can judge for themselves, but hopefully, at least at the very least, my excitement about all this stuff comes through on the pages.
And, you know, I'm glad that you brought up Night of the Living Dead, because while, yeah, there's just countless resources on it out there, I think that fans are always hungry to hear about it. I know that I am. It's just such a fascinating movie, not just because it's, you know, political or is doing something new or interesting. It's just so, like, spooky and classic, and it's just, like, one of my favorites, which gets me into thinking, we're talking about two of our favorite Romero projects of all time. And I'm going to start with mine, which is Night of the Living Dead, but the 1990 remake. You are like the PhD of Romero, but I was wondering, could I try to give us a little bit of like a brief history of this film?
Of course, go for it.
Okay, but make sure you fill in the blanks. So Night of the Living Dead, which I think is also known as George A. Romero's Night of the Living Dead, is a 1990 like remake of the original film directed by Mr. Tom Savini. This is the first time Tom Savini would ever direct. And of course, everyone knows him as basically like the master of gore in modern horror. He has done the practical gore effects for basically every of your favorite classic horror films. And this was the first time this dude was finally getting to direct and really take charge completely. It had a great cast. So it starred Tony Todd in the lead role as Ben. And we also
Pre-Candyman Tony Todd.
Oh, is it? That's right. This is 1 or 2 years before Candyman. Yeah. That's true.
This was his first horror movie.
That's so interesting. Okay, we're going to just for literally 1 second, I have to ask, did this lead to Candyman, do you think? Or do you think that, no?
Well, I mean, I feel like this is what put him in the, like, realm of horror for agents.
Well, because Candyman was so soon after, it's hard, like, it could have been nearly at the same time. Hard to know.
Yeah. So the one thing that I would say is that I love his performance in this movie.
Me too.
Because after Candyman, as much as I love Tony Todd, it's very clear that, like, you know, directors saw him in Candyman and were like, do that. Be menacing and mysterious.
You're right. It
and he's able to he's able to be heroic. He's able to be kind of a dick and he's complex.
And just as Ben was the first time around, he's such a real character. This is just a very interesting person to watch in this very intense, interesting situation. But to finish off,
you're talking about the cast.
Yeah.
No, but we got through one name. You were like, cast is amazing. This was
fucking right. The only other name I want to mention is Patricia Tallman as, oh my God, help me out, Barbara?
Yeah.
What, I have to be honest with you, unfortunately, I actually don't know much about Patricia Tallman. I think 10 years ago, I remember going on her IMDb and seeing interesting things, but I could not remember anything now, so you're going to have to help me out. But she is such a fascinating reimagination of Barbara. She's definitely has more autonomy. She's definitely more complex. She feels she's badass. She feels post Ellen Ripley a little bit, but not in a reductive way. And she's got such cool hair. Her haircut's so fucking cool. What else is she from?
So her first movie was Knight Riders, the George Romero Ren Faire bicycle jousting.
Yes, we've talked about it. Yeah,
motorcycle jousting. I like the idea of a bicycle jousting movie, though.
Also funny. Both funny.
And okay, I think so she was also a stunt woman. And then she worked pretty steadily in TV mostly after this.
She didn't really break out into mainstream sort of lead roles.
No, but she was always working. There's a lot of entries on her IMDb page.
She's so fascinating.
You're overlooking also in the cast is Bill Moseley, Chop Top himself.
Oh, that's right.
Taking the Russ Strainer role as Johnny, and Tom Tolles from Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer, who gives a very, when I rewatched this recently, and also, for book stuff, have been rewatching Night of the Living Dead for more than one screening I've introduced. And the thing about the original is that Harry, the white, middle-class patriarch who's a real dick to Ben and everybody, and he wants to go in the basement, etc. He's kind of pitiful, and any time that he threatens Ben, because Ben is played by Dwayne Jones, who's impossibly charismatic and so handsome.
Oh yeah.
So handsome that anybody who's interested in dudes, and maybe some people who don't, who see that movie for the first time,
and they're like, whoa.
Wow. Who's that? What else was he in?
Have you seen Gondra and Hess?
Yeah, he's exceptional in that. Yeah,
whoa,
he's great.
That's a sexy movie.
Yeah. But anyways, so in the original, the guy who's scoring up against Dwayne Jones gives a low-key hilarious performance as this pitiful little man.
Yes.
And the thing is, when you cast Tom Tolles, any time that Tom Tolles from Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer says something vaguely aggressive, you're somebody lock that man up, tie him up in the basement.
Yeah, it's dangerous.
And put blindfolds over him. He's clearly dangerous.
And I think that's actually a really good evolution for this role, because this archetype, this mega type, is so dangerous and really scary. So making him that way, I think, actually makes a lot of sense. For those who don't know, I'll just say really quickly, both the original film and this film are just about a group of strangers that meet up randomly and have to survive a zombie apocalypse in one house together. And some decide to stay upstairs, some go downstairs, and, interpersonal drama unfolds. This one came out. I just want to say yes to your point of these other two actors in this film. Kind of an Expendables of horror, really. A little bit before we knew who they were, especially for Tony Todd, but whoa.
Yeah.
Expendables of horror energy. Columbia Pictures put it out on October 19th, 1990. A lot of nines. And I don't think people liked it. I think that the reviews were negative, which is really too bad that you like that critics didn't learn their lesson from the original Night of the Living Dead and, you know, see this for what it was. I think definitely it's had a reevaluation in recent years, but that doesn't help it when it came out and it needed box office, you know, monies. I think it made about $6 million against a budget of 4-ish. So I don't know if that's necessarily a flop, but I can only imagine that that's not exactly like thrilling. And it's just too bad.
I think
it's so good.
It did fine.
It did fine.
Like, okay. Not enough that it was like, yeah, you know, nobody lost money. Everybody made money, which was like
no sequel.
The reason why this was made was because, you know, like for the distributor of Night of the Living Dead first refused to give the producers their share of the profits.
Mm-hmm.
And then after a couple of years, when people figured out that it was in the public domain because the distributor had fucked up and taken the copyright notice off when they changed the title, because it was filmed under the title Night of the Flesh Eaters.
Uh-huh.
So this is this is the state of copyright law in 1968 when it was released, which doesn't make any fucking sense.
Wait. So do you think, I'm sorry to interrupt you, that this could then feasibly be known as Night of the Living Dead, : George's version? Do you know what Christ. I'm referencing here?
I'm going to just move on.
No, so you do get the reference. Later. I'm sorry, yeah. You have to say it works. It is kind of what it is. They're getting their money from time.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is, yeah.
Yeah.
But it was also like, so it was less driven by George needing the money, like,
uh-huh,
than everybody else who worked on it. You know, like, for George Romero, this was a calling card that, you know, like, he was in the wilderness for a while, but he did get, like, big movies, you know?
Yeah,
and,
yeah,
like, he was able creative, to work, yeah, and people were funding his movies, even if it wasn't everything he wanted to make, etc. But, you know, for the other people who put so much time and effort and blood and sweat into Night of the Living Dead, you know, they really didn't see all that much out of it. So this was an opportunity to, like, you know, the executive producers include John Russo and Russell Striner, who, you know, where John Russo co-wrote the original script and he's in it as a zombie. Russ Striner did a ton of different things on, you know, on the set.
Mm-hmm.
And he played Johnny, and, you know, it was like a way to give his collaborators a payday, but also it was increasingly clear that because it was in the public domain, even though the original producers were like, they were trying to be proactive in like suing folks who tried to claim they were Night of the Living Dead. They had some success with that. Eventually somebody is going to figure out a way to make it. So it might as well be them. Mm-hmm. Right. And then a couple folks could get like a paycheck. Tom Savini could get his first directing gig. A bunch of cast and crew from Pittsburgh could have,
yeah,
a job.
And you're making the same story, but instead of for $3, you have like $4 million.
Yeah, yeah, right. And George didn't have to direct it, so, you know.
Even better, you were telling me a little bit earlier today that, you know, it seemed less like a less stressful experience for George and a more stressful experience for Tom. Do you want to talk about that briefly?
Oh, yeah. So, like, I don't know how prevalent this rumor is, but I have been asked by more than one person because, you know, like, I do Romero stuff. Like, is it true that George Romero ghost directed, like, secretly directed the Night of the Living Dead remake? Which, if I'm Tom Savini, I should be like simultaneously both insulted but also complimented by, because what they're saying is like, oh, this is very good, you know. Yeah, like a first time director should probably not be able to be that good first time out.
Yeah.
But
it's rude. And it's
first of all, like, there's no evidence supporting that. But second of all, mm-hmm, I've seen a bunch of behind the scene photographs. And anytime George Romero is on set, he is having the best time in the world.
Uh-huh.
He is, you know, declaring it 6 o'clock somewhere.
Uh-huh.
and, you know, sipping something and just like letting it all hang out. He's having a great time. No worries, no responsibilities. Mm-hmm. Any picture of Tom Savini, who is, by the way, rocking a pretty amazing ponytail at this point.
Nice.
Yeah. Just looks like the most stressed out a human being has ever been. Aww, and he always has like binders of stuff in front of him. Like he is clearly figuring all this shit out.
Yeah.
Supposedly he did not have a good time directing this movie. And so yeah. I guess that's why he didn't do another one. But that is a shame because this is a good movie.
So, and it doesn't have the legacy it deserves yet. I came across it a little bit later in life. And as I said, I do think that reassessment has happened, but I still don't think this really gets the flowers that it's owed.
It should. It definitely needs to be reclaimed by people who want to see a movie about like a fucking badass lady like yelling at men who suck and kicking their asses.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. She is just so underrated. Maybe it's because of the, you know, the original character, Barbara has a little bit, you know, has some baggage, I guess, but.
Well, I mean, it's very clear that like this was an opportunity for Romero to kind of like deal with the stuff that had bothered him about the original for a while.
Okay.
You know, like the original Barbara, like she was clearly written as this kind of like audience surrogate where they pull the rug out from underneath the audience, you know, like she's the pretty blonde lady. She's going to be our heroine that we're going to like root for throughout or whatever. Yeah. And like, she survives the initial zombie attack, but then gets to this like, you know, farmhouse in the middle of Evan City,
yeah,
and goes completely catatonic and is a non-entity who can barely like react to the world around her for the rest of it.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. I just remembered. Yeah, it's her brother. That's the Mosley role. I always forgot. I forgot for a second there. But
yeah.
He gets the famous line. And, you know, that's such a famous scene, the opening scene from the original, that I do think the opening scene from this does get to exist in our zeitgeist a little bit more than the rest of the movie. Because, like, there's gifts from that opening and all of that.
Yeah. But like, you know, so like after that initial scene when this actress, this character who we thought was going to be like, you know, it's like a very clear sort of like post-psycho mm-hmm. re-envisioning of like a horror movie structure, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like here's the lady, the pretty lady we're going to root for. And then immediately after she survives the first thing and we've been rooting for her, turns out that she sucks. She's not going to do anything. And we're going to get really annoyed with her and instead root for the black guy. Yeah.
Which works 100% for when it came out.
It does. And like it, all of that makes sense.
Yeah.
But after the fact, you know, having it pointed out to them like, well, having this woman character who's so scared that she's just like a burden on everybody and can't like do anything. That's not great.
No.
And clearly Romero had reflected on that. And he's like, okay, well,
yeah,
you've got a point.
And not every woman character needs to be Mary Sue levels of like competent, but because of when it came out, it just felt like this waifish, helpless, you know, damsel. And he's so cognizant of, you know, he's just so cognizant of politics that I think I can imagine that it would bother him after the fact.
Yeah. I mean, if the original is largely about, you know, not just the disintegration of society, but this like, you know, really viscerally communicating the fear about like being a black man in America, and particularly like in rural America.
Oof.
The remake is about being a woman. You know, she's surrounded by mm-hmm. dudes who are awful for every different way you could imagine a dude being awful.
Yep.
There's one of them in this movie somewhere. Which is an achievement considering like there's not that many speaking roles. But they really map it out really well.
And yeah. And unlike the original, as I was saying, like, it's not campy. It's not for fun. It's not played for laughs. It's, like, disturbing and realistic and, like, scary.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good movie. I like it a lot.
I like it, too. But on that note, I'd like to move on to, you know, what your potential favorite Romero title is. And we talked about it before we hit record today. And it's not that it's, like, definitively your favorite Romero film, but you are going to bring to the table Martin. Do you want to tell us a little bit about this movie?
So, yeah. So first thing that I'll say is that Martin has been very difficult to watch for a long time. Mm. But miraculously, possibly, illegally, it's streaming on Tubi.
Oh.
And even with commercial interruptions, like, I can't recommend this movie enough.
Wow.
I love this fucking movie, even though there's sort of... It's Romero's most disturbing, upsetting movie in, like, a not fun way. You know, it's basic, like, it's a vampire story, but it's really basically about, like, a serial killer who's compelled to kill for sexual reasons that he can't quite articulate. And, you know, like, he just, like, feels a psychological need. He can't do it or else he starts to feel sick and whatever. The amazing thing about the movie is that all of that upsetting and disturbing stuff about what Martin, the character, does, doesn't really interfere with the movie's ability to empathize with him. Okay. And, like, I mean empathize versus sympathize in the sense of, like, you can feel for him. Like, he is pitiful, he is sick, he can't help this. But at the same time, the stuff that he does is horrifying. And that's something that, like, you don't see very often in any kind of movie, let alone a horror movie. Like, that sort of nuance and complexity. And I love that about it. It also makes it a tough sell. It's not fun in the way that, like, Dawn of the Dead is fun, you know? There's no slapstick zombies falling down escalators.
I haven't seen it, but do you think in some ways it kind of predates what we now call prestige or elevated horror with A24 and Neon and, you know, Hereditary and The Babadook and all that?
Yeah, I mean, all of Romero's stuff does, but this feels like it could be produced by A24.
Right?
It was distributed by the same company that distributed Eraserhead. You know, like, that's a sort of, like, if you think about that as, like, Eraserhead being a horror-ish movie that's also really arty and avant-garde, that's an A24 roster of films.
And
right,
was it
there,
cool?
You know?
Like, was this, like, considered to be, you know, like, trendy or...
No, it never really got a chance to hit. I think that the unexpected... people in Romero's circle blame Eraserhead, basically.
That's so funny.
But in their defense, like, you know, it was a small distributor that did not have much resources. So, you know, seeing them put it behind this, like, the weirdest movie they'd ever seen.
Yeah. It was a
and
good
it somehow exceeding succeeding yeah. makes yeah. it feel like, well, couldn't you have, like, done some of that for us, maybe?
Yeah, they should have.
But yeah, it barely got a release. It didn't play in most cities. And, you know, like, for copyright reasons that are complicated and awful, like, it's not on Blu-ray in the United States. I think it might be, or it's coming out in the UK or whatever. But it's a legitimately great movie. I think that it's his greatest achievement.
Wow, that's a lot, considering you are the guy that wrote the book on Romero.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not all that well known, but I'm always willing to talk Martin with people.
Well, I think it's kind of interesting that, you know, my favorite of Romero was Night of the Living Dead remake directed by Tom Savini. But am I right to say that Martin was the first collaboration between Savini and Romero?
Yes, but that was not the first time that they met. Have I told you that before?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Remind me.
So they actually met for a project, a film that Romero was trying to get made in the mid-1960s called Wine of the Fawn, a very like arty, pretentious Ingmar Bergman-esque thing that has like, I don't know, I can talk about it. Endlessly, it's fascinating. One of the greatest endings of any scripts I've ever read.
Oh, okay.
Very uneven up till then. But you know, like there was nothing about this, like you know, this script about an innocent youth in medieval England encountering various temptations and threats that like seemed to equal profits to potential funders. So they never got enough money even though they wrote it like, you know, with budget in mind.
Classic Romero.
So that was never made, but also they didn't cast Savini, who was young, and he ended up like, that's before he went to Vietnam. And when he got back, like he looked up Romero and they got together and worked on
had such a crazy amazing career together. And
my understanding is that like he was an actor first who assisted with makeup, and then like he was so good at the makeup
that I love it. You gotta do what you're good at. What a babe.
You know, I live around the corner from Tom Savini. Like he's I don't know, only a few blocks away. I don't know how much I've never spoken to him in my life. I don't know how much time he spends in Pittsburgh, but like everybody knows what house is Tom Savini's.
Cool.
Everybody knows, or everybody knew up until a few years ago, that like if you ever wanted to see him, just hang out at the Bloomfield pool in the summer. And he would frequently be there.
Oh, cool.
Just hanging out. He's a real Pittsburgh guy. But also everybody knew that you don't say anything to him because, like, he's a shy, private guy.
Uh-huh.
And the reputation is, like, it's not that he's not nice, but that if, like, you're in a coffee shop and he's there, if you start walking towards him with, like, an air of purpose,
he will just
stand up and walk out of the
You know what? And that's his right to do. Imagine being an introvert celebrity. Hell on earth. The last question, though, before we move away from Martin, is I understand that there was a bit of a controversy in the UK with the release of this movie. Does that sound familiar?
I mean, yeah, it was one of, you know, a bunch of films that were controversial for various reasons. Mm-hmm. It is a disturbing, like I said, it is a very disturbing movie, but it's not particularly
bad, you know,
graphic. It's the ideas that are disturbing.
Mm-hmm. It looks like just the idea, and I've never seen it, but of like a cute sort of teenage heartthrob type that like thinks he's a vampire and like literally kills people and sucks their blood, but like this is a real person. That's gross. I love it. I have to watch it.
Yeah, it's amazing. So the original version of Martin, which is my favorite discovery from the archive, maybe, that like I made and like discovered and put like connected all the dots myself, was that the first version of Martin was an abandoned fragment of a novel that Romero was working on in the early 70s about a dissatisfied but narcissistic middle-aged businessman. And then he got one chapter in, and that's all there was. But the character was named Martin Matthias. And there was a, at the end of the fragment, there's a page of notes that seems to be listing possibilities of where to take this character. And there's like, there's nothing supernatural or horror in the fragment, mm-hmm. but there's a few supernatural horror genre ideas in this page of notes.
That's fucking cool.
He picks it up a couple of years later with a character named Martin Matthias as a middle-aged man who suddenly like has a late in life onset of vampirism. And it's a very clear metaphor for addiction, you know, like some like a middle-aged dude who's spiraling because of like alcohol or cocaine or something like that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that it's closest to is Bruiser, Romero's first Toronto movie.
How dare you?
It's interesting. There's a couple of different versions of it. He doesn't write a full script. It's just a treatment. And there's one version that's short that's just like an idea for a movie about what realistically it would be like to be a vampire, which means like being immortal, so you can't like have any sort of a public profile or any sort of permanence, and like how you would be able to kill people and feed off them without drawing attention to yourself, and like the portrait that emerges in just like these few pages is of like this blurry, depressing, like gritty existence of almost like a perpetual hobo who always lives like in squalor, moving constantly, never having any like fixed address, but like you know, metaphorically riding the rails of society.
Michael Myers in Halloween Ends. Keep going. I'm sorry.
That's not a reference that I get fully, but that's okay. We should move on.
Okay.
But anyways, at that point it was called Blood, and it was like announced, like, you know, there were advertisements for it. Like, you know, coming soon, George Romero's new movie Blood. And I don't know why it didn't happen. It was going to be produced by a dude who had, I think, at that point exclusively been doing American distribution for Italian horror movies.
That kind of makes sense.
It does. And, you know, that connection may have led to a couple of things in Romero's career, possibly including Dawn of the Dead. There's like no way to entangle that at this point. But, you know, like it may be that just like the distributor thought that he would be better at producing than he was and didn't end up like raising enough money or whatever. But there's no real explanation for why it didn't happen. When he finally writes a script a couple of years later, it's because he wants to make a goddamn movie. Like, it's not, like, in the scheme of things, not all that long. But so he makes Night in 67 into 68, comes out in 68. And then after a couple of years, makes There's Always Vanilla, Season of the Witch, and The Crazies, like, bam, 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 real quick. And basically by 1972, he's washed up because all three of those are flops or don't get distribution. You know, Season of the Witch and Crazies get they do get recuperated later. People discover them. But like at the time, nothing, no money. And George is super in debt. The initial group that was kind of a cooperative, very like Midwestern hippie in the sense that like they're very practical but also are like, you know, communal, collaborative, everybody gets a voice, like that all breaks up. They had been together for over a decade and George has to start over, with a new producer, raising money, figuring out a way to get out of debt and all that. And so it's a few years, you know, Dawn of the Dead and Martin both come out 78, 79. Mm-hmm. He starts working in earnest on Martin in 76. So that's like after 4 years of making commercials mm-hmm. and trying to get productions off the ground and making stuff for TV, he's like, I just got to fucking make a movie. And he makes Martin because he can make it for really cheap with footage that basically he embezzles from TV projects.
Good for him.
Like, you know, just some Good. Very creative accounting.
He got the bag. And I'm guessing that's why they made the lead role, you know, like a teenager, like a heartthrob type.
No, actually, like he still wrote it as a middle-aged dude. But then the story is that he sees a college student in a school play. And it's like, I should cast him. And so he rewrites the role for John Amplis.
I think that was probably the right move.
Yeah. So, you know, like everything changes. This is also like a really good indication of how Romero worked. Like he was always open to new ideas, mm-hmm. whether that was like, you know, something from an actor or somebody behind the set, behind the scenes, just like sitting around on the set, like extras or whatever. He would always talk to them about stuff and he wasn't too precious about the script. To the point that like characters and scenes could be like drastically reimagined, but also like, you know, I mean, casting a teenager for a role written for a middle-aged dude is not like in America, it's more loaded or it's less loaded, I guess. But it's not all that different than casting Dwayne Jones, a black man, for a role in Night of the Living Dead that was, if you don't know, was originally written as like a stereotypical redneck Southern type.
Mm-hmm.
He was just like open to whatever inspiration, like good fortune brought to him.
And also like having a teenager speak what was supposed to be the words of a middle-aged man might even give some like weight to the idea that like, could he be a vampire?
Yeah, it makes it really interesting. Amplis's performance is remarkable in that movie.
Well, I mean, if you're like me and you have not seen this movie, sounds like it's on Tubi. Get out there and watch it because I'm definitely going to soon.
The streaming service for the people, Tubi, owned by Fox News or whatever it's owned by.
Well, that's too bad. But you joke, but it is like, it is the zone for horror. Like, it's so impressive what they have on there. And like, I am just so grateful as a horror fan for Tubi. And if you're listening to this, maybe just like give us an ad or something. and on that note, I thought maybe it would, you know, be elegant to end off this whole series by touching base on some of the other unmade projects from Romero that maybe we didn't have time to do in as an individual episode, but still deserve to be talked about because they are just so fascinating. We're going to be talking about a bunch of Stephen King adaptations. We're going to talk about an original project called... Oh, no. We're going to be talking about
Copperhead.
And... a comedy, I believe, called Monster Mash, and then also something interesting called The Golem. So to start us off today, I thought maybe we could dig into the Stephen King adaptations that didn't end up happening. For those who don't know, Romero had been developing his own version of Salem's Lot, The Stand, Pet Sematary, It, The Girl Who
Children of the Corn.
Children of the Corn, The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon, From a Buick 8, and I'm guessing more. So he has, like, had his hand at adapting Unmade King like nobody else. And, you know, as a huge King fan, I find that so fascinating. You know, of all of these titles, like, you know, which ones come to mind for you for like fascinating development stories?
So, first of all, like, Stephen King was a huge Romero fan pretty early on. Like, he especially loved Dawn of the Dead, and like that's why they worked together for Creepshow, you know.
Cool.
And there was a point where King basically wanted Romero to be his like
movie
his
guy,
adapter. Like his Mike Flanagan, you know.
Got it.
Like,
got it.
At that point, like every movie would at least go by George, like he'd get the first crack at it. But you know how Stephen King writes like 8,000 page novels all the time?
Mm-hmm.
They had trouble getting funding for somebody like George Romero, who had been working in the indie world for movies that were not particularly respected by Hollywood, even if they made money. And so, like, my understanding, and I should say, like, there are, I'm sure Stephen King himself could correct a lot of this, and there are producers who could. This is all sort of partial information, but from what I've been able to piece together, there were just, like, they were unable to get together the necessary money for something like The Stand, which is a tough thing to adapt into a feature film, especially if, like, you know, you want to get it, you want to get in and out in 2 hours for the goddamn Stand. Like, that kind of
fucking Dark Tower 2017. Yeah, no, it doesn't work.
Yeah, no, I don't think that it works. But also, I think if it's going to work as a feature, it needs to be 3 hours and like elaborate.
Which
and nobody is willing to give that money to Romero. And almost every Stephen King novel in the, like, through the 1980s was attached to Romero at some point.
It looks like it, yeah.
They loved working together for Creepshow, which is a movie that I adore. I love Creepshow so much.
One of the best.
I'm glad that it's finally kind of like assumed its rightful place in the canon, you know, in the pantheon.
Are you saying it wasn't loved by fans the way that it is now?
No, not at all. It was like, it did fine.
Oh, I hear you.
You know, like, it did fine. It wasn't a huge hit. It was kind of like, and, you know, people thought of it fondly, some people, but it's not until like the last 10, 15 years that you could be like, wait, what? You've never seen Creepshow? It's the greatest movie ever made. And not have people like say, what the fuck are you talking about? Like, yeah.
And it got a fucking theatrical sequel, which I'm still kind of amazed by. And we've talked about it before. I'm not going to get into it long, but it's worth it for The Raft. The Raft is the scariest fucking segment of any movie. So I love Creepshow.
It's pretty great. It's pretty great.
Yeah.
But so the projects, the King projects that got the furthest along that Romero was working on, were It and Pet Sematary. And then, of course, he makes The Dark Half, which is...
Oh, yeah.
It's a compromised movie that Romero had a terrible time on. It was fighting with both the studio and, from what I hear, the star as well. I feel like I'm getting into gossip territory saying that, but like, I don't think that he, like, and Timothy Hutton got along at all. But it's not just like a clash of personality. Like, the star was like refusing to work for George Romero. Poor fucking guy. Poor George.
You, James Bond.
No, that's Timothy Dalton.
Wait, who is this?
Hutton.
I don't know the difference. Oh, no.
It's fine.
Okay. Yeah. So it didn't really happen again the way that it happened the first time around with Creepshow between these two, which is a bit of a shame.
So I can talk a little bit about those two projects. But first of all, like, there's two kinds of King projects for Romero. One of them is Creepshow, where Stephen King writes a script, and that, like, that is the almost the only time in his career when Romero does not work on the script at all. Mm-hmm. Like, he worked on creative side of, like, you know, I'm sure there's some feedback between him and King, and there is, you know, like obviously, like, the visual side of things and all of that, but he doesn't tinker with Stephen King's scripts in the same way that he would for anybody else. And then there's adaptation. So that's one kind. And then there's adaptations of King's novels, where if King was not the person writing the actual script, then Romero felt, you know, the freedom to change things, to elaborate on things, and, like, become a contributing writer to the script. So Pet Sematary was something that Stephen King was going to write. And it seems like the reason that that didn't happen, like, Romero was waiting around wanting to make that. It was material that, like, as a, you know, like, as a boomer dad, spoke to him, like, very deeply. You know, the way that it dealt with feelings about children and your fears about what could happen to your family, that sort of thing. It resonated, and he wanted to make that film, but the timing didn't work out. Partially because, you know, like, Stephen King was, at the time they were trying to get this made, doing Maximum Overdrive, his directorial debut.
Which, you and, know, Romero probably should have directed.
Well, I will also say that King was being unresponsive at this time. And if you know anything about Stephen King's biography at the time of Maximum Overdrive, you can sort of read into what else was happening that was delaying this project. Like cocaine. Yeah. I'm talking about cocaine. And I should say this is speculation on my part. It's a little better than speculation. It is an educated analysis of the situation that has no evidence whatsoever.
I'm with you.
Of, like, that being that factoring into this. But
still,
I do know that, like, Romero was so excited about it that he started doing storyboards that he drew himself. You know, like, he was an artist. He was kind of more like a fun illustrator than, like, a fine artist, you know? And, like, he drew by hand, like, a bunch of storyboards based on a partial script that King had written. And then just, like, the timing never worked out for that, because eventually Romero had to take another job. This is post Day of the Dead. Mm-hmm. He had to do Monkey Shines if he wanted to keep working. And then, like, there's other, like, interpersonal complications with his producer, but it's mainly timing with that.
Mm-hmm.
Around the same time, he was also working on It, the miniseries with Tim Curry. Not that Tim Curry was on board at that point,
mm-hmm.
but that was a script. So if for Pet Sematary, he was waiting for Stephen King to produce the script so he could film it. For this, there was a script. And I don't know what happened. I'm sure that it's just part of the, like, normal process of anything that gets made, you know, in, like, TV/Hollywood, that directors come in and out for reasons that I would not fully understand. Mm-hmm. But that was a script that was written by Lawrence D. Cohen, and Romero had, like...
Are you talking about It right now? Just to be clear.
Yeah, It. Sorry.
No, don't.
Romero, like, had a lot of notes. He had a lot of suggestions about, like, how to deal with characters. He had one suggestion that I loved, which was that they really had to lose the spider aspect.
Smart.
Which my like deduction that my colleague Ben Rubin and I came up with. So they had a similar thing for Creepshow. Because in the original story for The Crate,
Mm-hmm.
Which is the one where there's the where there's Fluffy, the like ape-ish monster from the Arctic.
Yeah.
That's a spider thing in the original story.
Oh, that's scary.
But Romero could never get that to work. Like, he could never get it to, like, look convincing. Like, it always looked like a 1950s sort of, like, rubber, okay, you know, monster sort of thing.
The ape was scary, so they made the right move.
No, it's great. We all love, don't get me wrong, we love Fluffy. There's a Fluffy mural in my neighborhood.
Nice icon. Yeah. Bring back Fluffy. Anyway.
Yeah. You know, so my guess is that that's why he was like, maybe we shouldn't do a spider. We'll never make it look convincing. Yep. Let's try to think about other ideas. But there was like, you know, a like 60 or 70 page document going through the script, scene by scene, line by line, with suggestions. And then who knows why that didn't work out. Probably, again, it was timing. Yeah. Whoa. So the last Romero King project was The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon.
Oh, I'm glad we're going to talk about this because this is a book I love.
So that is a project that Romero started working on, like, because he loved the book, and he just like wrote a letter to Stephen King that's in the archive that just like is asking him, like, I love this book. Can I,
would you mind if I just tell people briefly like what it's about?
Oh yeah, go for it.
So The Girl Loved Tom Gordon, I think came out in 1998, maybe 1999, is a story about a little girl who goes on a walk with her mom and older brother in the woods. And in order to stop hearing her family bickering and fighting, she kind of holds back and is sort of lost in her own world, and then finds that she is, in fact, very, very much lost in the woods. And as the story goes on, she gets more and more lost, and it becomes this very real, very emotional survival story of this preteen girl who has this obsession with baseball, lost in the woods and doing her best to survive. And as the story goes on, you know, she starts to sort of encounter monstrous creatures, and you're unsure if it's just because she's dehydrated or not. It's a little bit in vein of Gerald's Game in that way. And it's, I would say, one of his only sort of YA appropriate novels, and it's really beautiful.
Yeah, it's really lovely. And Romero started writing scripts for it. He worked on it like throughout the rest of his life, basically. Mainly in those first few years, like early 2000s. But it's still alive. And the version of it that's supposedly still in development, it's been a couple of years, so we'll see. But is like a descendant of that original Romero script. So the director attached to it is Lynn Ramsey, who's one of the great living directors who does not get to make all that many films. She would be the perfect match for the material.
Definitely. Big time. Am I right to say, I remember back in the day that another director attached was Romero's ex-wife at one point?
No, she wasn't a director. She was a screenwriter.
Oh, really? Okay. So the only woman to ever be attached, to my knowledge, then would be Lynn Ramsey?
To direct, I think she's the first director other than George that has been announced.
Okay, so it was going to be
like
George.
Maybe, you know, I have not dug through the archives of Variety for this, but it was never planned.
Okay, interesting.
To be directed by anybody but George, yeah.
I would have loved to see what he could have done with it. Very cool. What time is it? Well, I think this might be good timing for us to sort of move into our next era of Romero. There is an unproduced Marvel, I believe, project he was working on called Copperhead. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so this was known by a few different titles, all of them pretty bad, because as we have discussed several times in this miniseries, George Romero is terrible at titles. So in 1981, George Romero meets Jim Shooter, who was at the time the editor-in-chief of Marvel Comics, Pittsburgh guy. Very nice, very just like full of energy and ideas. He's nice, but prickly. It's a personality type that in Pittsburgh we're familiar with. He and George hit it off instantly. And they start cooking up a collaboration. It is a kind of before a proto RoboCop version of RoboCop. Like that was a few years off at this point. It's a science fiction story that would be about like a soldier who is transformed into a military robot for a futuristic fascist regime, and like the slow coming to realization and fighting over control over his own humanity sort of thing.
Okay.
It's really great. It's got like a bunch of kind of gloriously cheesy stuff to it, but also like big political ideas. It's a science fiction movie that gave him a science fiction canvas, and he loved it.
I mean, it's bizarre that we almost got a Marvel film out of Romero.
It would have been the first Marvel film. Yeah. Wow. And he and Jim Shooter were great collaborators. They worked together really well. They were the kind of collaborators who would do alternate drafts, and like every draft like improves on the last. The last one that was sent to the other, it would have been awesome. It would have been really great. And it's like I said, it's just bursting with ideas. This was the era where Romero really wanted to get that big canvas, you know, like not for spectacle, although he obviously would have loved that too, but more because like, he had all of these political critiques and wanted to like, critiques is not the right word. He wanted to explore political ideas, societal ideas. Mm-hmm. And in order to do that properly, he needed to depict the society.
Yeah.
And have more than just like, you know, six people in a small space talking about the society or embodying the society. He wanted to actually show it. And, you know, you can feel that excitement about like the scope, the grand scope of this. And it rules. Like he and Jim worked on this for 4 years about. It eventually peters out because they couldn't get any funding for it. There's a couple of advertisements for it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, in Variety. I mean, this does not, you know, like there's all sorts of unfilmed projects that are advertised in Variety as a way of like raising money for them.
Mm-hmm.
But none of them call it Copperhead. They refer to it as something like the hero of the century is coming from Marvel Comics and Laurel Pictures or Laurel Entertainment or whatever it was at the time.
What did they call it? Give me the title one more time.
The hero of the century, but it was unclear that was like the title. It's unclear what it was about. It's just it's not a very helpful ad to see, basically. I love those scripts so much. They're phenomenal. And eventually, like, you know, word about RoboCop coming, like being developed, starts to come out. And that's like the final. That is the final nail in the coffin, but it was dead long before then.
And then a little bit of offline information. I think I'm going to skip Monster Mash because we're at the hour mark and just head directly into Gollum.
Yeah.
Copperhead sounds crazy, but another project that I was hoping we'd get some time to discuss today would be Romero's version of the Gollum. For people that don't know, like, what the traditional Gollum story is, could you maybe give us some, you know, context?
Yeah, so this is like a traditional Jewish story coming from, I think, specifically Czechoslovakia, but also Eastern and Central Europe more broadly.
Can I pause you and say that my grandfather is from what was once Czechoslovakia? Am I the golem?
I think that's what that means. Yeah.
Okay.
So Romero wasn't Jewish, but he was interested in this idea of the golem, in part because it is a monstery creature that does your bidding, but with limitations. And one of the limitations, according to, you know, the version of the story that George had heard or believed or, you know, wanted to use, is that the golem could do your bidding if your intentions and your heart were pure. And that if not, then if you were doing it for personal gain or for, you know, something awful, for personal gain, for military gain, for whatever.
Mischief.
Yeah, that's what the armies of the world do, is mischief.
That's
yeah.
my opinion, yeah. And I'm assuming
but so that, he was interested in that.
Uh-huh.
And there's two golem stories in his filmography, his oeuvre, let's say, not filmography. One is a script from the 90s, mid-90s. This is kind of early CGI, so he was clearly envisioning a monster that could do CGI stuff, that could morph and change shapes and like merge into shadows and columns and other sorts of forms all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And the other was the last thing he ever finished. It's a short story called The Liberator. It was for a collaboration with an old friend, also named George from Pittsburgh, George Nama, who is a very accomplished visual artist. And the two of them collaborated on this gallery show that played a couple of different, you know, like high-end prestigious art galleries played that was at a couple of these places. Only like 3 months after Romero died. So it wasn't the last thing he was working on necessarily. That's a little,
that's the last thing he wrote, stuff. I guess.
It's the last thing he finished.
Wow. Yeah.
It's a short story. So the script for the 90s version is wild. It's really fun. And I just love, I love the basic setup, which is that the U.S. military has figured out that they can conjure a golem by using computers, basically.
Cool.
Because the way that you bring a golem to life is by having a piece of paper, putting a piece of paper with the correct sequence of Hebrew letters written on it into like the chest of the golem.
Who knew?
Well, so the military figures out that like, well, we have computers. Let's print out every possible combination of Hebrew letters.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And put that whole stack into this golem that we've constructed, and then that will bring it to life. And they are correct. It works, but their hearts were not pure. They wanted to for malicious purposes, for mischief.
Uh-huh.
That's the way to describe the U.S.
It's nice.
The U.S. military in the 90s, right?
Oh, yeah. And, I mean, they were puckish. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Little okay, scant. So it doesn't go well.
It does not go well. So instantly, everybody involved becomes a target of this golem.
I love that. That's
and,
great.
It's a wonderful script that like has not only like the most satisfying resolution of any of Romero's scripts, but like the only hopeful one, where like basically in the end, like the characters need to learn to be better.
I like that.
And
also
and like they like, quote unquote, defeat the golem. And it's people who are like aligned with the military, but not like they're in the military, but not of the military, let's say, who, you know, like I said, they basically like learn to be better. And they realize at the very end, like, oh, whatever this defeat is, it's only temporary. And like, if we ever step out of line again, like the golem might show back up and
I love it.
Slice Good. Our heads off or something.
It kind of has a mild ACAB vibe to it, which I do think ultimately is very Romero.
Yeah. Romero did not like authority.
No, who
and
does?
He did not like, you know, oppression or violence on a, like,
yeah,
he didn't like violence on a mass scale of any kind. Yeah. Whether it was a militia.
Yeah. And he doesn't like punching down either, which is why he's so great. Well, that sounds like a fuck lot of fun. I am interested, though, you know, maybe to wrap us up and a little bit more about the story.
The Liberator? Yeah. So this is a really poignant, very evocative and kind of impressionistic short story about an elderly man, a Jewish man who had been in World War II and had conjured a golem when he was there to help fight the fascists. You know, this is a story that restates this idea that you have to be pure of heart and pure in your intentions in order to successfully, like, get a golem on your side. And he is. But this takes place late in life. He's on his deathbed. And in a really interesting setup, he has a lot of children that he's kind of unofficially adopted. A lot of children that have just started, kind of come into his life. He's, you know, it's sort of implied that because of this violence in his life in World War II, when he killed all of these fascists, all of these Nazis, that even though that was heroic, like, there was this toll that took on him. And so he was never married, never had any children of his own, but these, like, orphans or, you know, it's unexplained in a way that I think invites you to think about this in allegorical, metaphorical terms. These children have kind of accrued around him. And so he tells them about the golem and conjures it and tells them that about, like, he's dying, but this creature will be there to protect them, but that they can never use it for self, like, for self-gain or greed. They can never use it for vengeance or malice. That if they do, it will turn around on them. And the first thing that they do as soon as he's gone is to tell him jokingly to go get some money for him. And so it ends with this, like, you know, brief suggestion about how this, like, you know, this next generation is going to be chased by the golem forever. For the rest of their lives, because they couldn't see beyond their own immediate desires. Yeah.
It's so scary. And it kind of gives a Frankenstein, too.
It does. And it's interesting because it is in part like a cranky old man sort of thing, you know, complaining about the younger generation. But it also feels like Romero really trying to reckon with his own legacy, you know. A legacy that's really wrapped up in not actual violence, but depictions of violence.
That's true.
All of these people that have come after him, you know, like I said, metaphorically, like, not his children, but these people that have just sort of, like, gathered around him and that look up to him. And, like, what has he taught them? What have they taken away from his films other than, like, well, we can make some money off of this?
Well,
it's touching as, like, a self a self-examination that he wrote just like in the last months of his life. It's beautifully written. And George Nama's illustrations are gorgeous.
Wow. I love that. I have to read that. I also think it's like a really nice way for you and I to wrap up our conversations about Romero, sort of from start to finish. I really want to thank you for joining me for these 5 episodes. They've been really fascinating. The audience have really loved it. And, you know, I have to ask, what's next for you? Like, you've written this book on Romero, you know, you're traveling in promotion of it. What do you foresee being on your horizon?
It's hard to say. I've been toying with the idea of trying to do a similar book on David Cronenberg, but it, you know, there's not the same sort of archive that Romero has. So like this would be a different project. It would be more about like the decision is basically like, do I have enough to say about David Cronenberg that would interest people?
Although he is alive, so that could help.
Yeah, he is. And I'm very excited for The Shrouds.
It
looks like it'll be out next year, probably. I don't really know. I really enjoyed writing this book. It's been nice connecting with people. I'm assuming that most people listening don't know that, like, nonfiction books, but especially for an academic press, like, you make $0 off of this. you do it because you are like passionate about it.
Yeah.
And want to share this stuff with an audience that will be appreciative. Mm-hmm. And I've found, I was went into this like pretty self-deprecatingly depressed about the prospects of like, you know, well, so I love George Romero, but I don't know that there's like actually an audience out there. And it feels like there is, like, people want to read this, and that's extremely gratifying. And yeah, like you said, I'm doing some more events. I'm talking with a couple of other places about doing stuff in the fall or over the summer. Be in Boston at the Coolidge Corner at the end of April, and then in Portland at the Hollywood, and in Seattle at the Northwest Film Forum and the Grand Illusion, it looks like. Talking George, introducing screenings, doing Q&As, and be towing some books with me to sign. And it's just really nice talking with people who love George Romero's movies. I spent so much time like thinking about this stuff. Getting it out of the world is nice. It's so satisfying.
And for people that want to make sure they're up to date on everything that you're doing, how can people find you online?
For however much longer Twitter lasts before like completely descending into like hell. The hell of Elon Musk Nazi Twitter, whatever. I'm on there at m_Hulot, like the Jacques Tati film. And I'm Adam Hart on Blue Sky, but like, I don't know, man. Social media is so much harder than it used to be. Like, who pays attention to what? I don't know. Trying, I don't know.
Oh, so you're Red not Central on TikTok?
Will. No, I'm not on TikTok. What happens on TikTok as a middle-aged man? What happens on TikTok?
It's not your business.
None of my business.
No, nor your responsibility. Where were you?
I hope that those kids are having fun. That's all that I.
Yeah. What were you just about to say about Dread Central?
Oh, I was going to say Dread Central will cover whatever I'm doing next, right, Josh?
100%. yes. And yeah, just one last time, can you remind us, what's your book? Where can we find it?
Yeah, so it's called Raising the Dead, the Work of George A. Romero. It's really fun. I put so much time and effort and excitement into this thing. And just really wanted to do George to make George proud from whatever sort of, non-religious afterlife he's looking down from. It's available at all the normal places that you would get a book from. Mm-hmm.
I love it. Well, it's been a blast talking to you about Romero these 5 weeks. Thank you for all of it. It's been great.
Yeah, this has been a blast. Thanks for this opportunity. People should feel free to reach out if they've read the book and have some questions or wanted to follow up on anything. Or if you want a Romero, quote unquote, expert to come introduce a screening or do a reading or something, let me know.
Thank you so much for listening to Development Hell. If you enjoy this podcast, then please do us a major favor of leaving us 5 stars and writing a positive review. It really makes all the difference in the world. We'll see you next week with a brand new episode of Development Hell.
Thank you for listening to the Dread Podcast Network.